o'clock hour. You're listening to KPFK. This is Manuel Criollo and my co-host Eric Mann. Today we will bring you voices from the front line. We have Harold Meyerson, editor-at-large of the American Prospect magazine, Veronica Obregón, a leader in the battered women's movement, to speak about the Rosario Muñoz campaign. And third, we have Carlos Montes, a leader of the Latino boycott strike, to talk about Proposition 187, number 2. Some of us were born with money to spend. Some of us were born.
It's Monday, the 29th of December, and I'm on the phone interviewing Harold Meyerson, the editor-at-large of the American Prospect. And Harold's been a long-time analyst of both the labor movement, democratic politics, and I'd say socialist politics writ large. Harold, what I'm going to do is begin with an article that I thought was very provocative, and it's not that new but important, by Ronald Brownstein in last Sunday's, that is the 28th. L.A. Times called for 2004, Bush has strength in the white male numbers, and this is Eric Mann on KPFK 90.7 FM. The Brownstein article begins, President Bush's overwhelming strength among white men looms as a central obstacle between Democrats and the White House as 2004 approaches. In an election season heavily shaped by terrorism and national security, seven recent polls suggest Bush could dominate white male voters as thoroughly as Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush did during their three successive presidential victories in the 1980s. In the modern political era, Democrats never expect to carry white men, who reliably tilt Republican. But the emerging threat to Democrats in 2004, Brownstein says, is that Bush will win with white men so decisively that the party can't overcome his advantage with other voter groups that lean in their direction, such as minorities and college-educated white women. Analysts in both parties agree that Bush is benefiting among white men from his aggressive use of force against terrorism and his alternately folksy and blunt, bring 'em on personal style. That's the best situation for us and the worst situation for them, they say, if Dean runs. White men compose just under 40% of the electorate, with white women just over 40%, and minorities composing the rest. White men have given Democrats problems in presidential elections for decades. Since the 1970s, Democrats have won when they kept the Republican advantage within sight and lost when they didn't. Then the article goes on and even explains about Ross Perot siphoning some white men away as a way to help Clinton. And then it says, with Perot off the ballot in 2000, the Republican advantage among white men ballooned again, as Bush carried them by 24 percentage points over Al Gore. That margin was just small enough to allow Gore to narrowly edge Bush in the popular vote by running strongly with other groups. Then he goes through a lot of different polls indicating that it's even looking worse in terms of white men moving to the Republican Party in even stronger numbers. Brownstein continues, the president's black and white pronouncements on terrorism and war, from his promise to capture Osama bin Laden dead or alive, to his bring 'em on taunt to Iraqi resistors, which generates unease among many women and even some more affluent men, helps cement Bush's attachment to blue-collar men, who recent polls show support him at higher levels than men with college degrees. It says here he runs kind of a testosterone-driven White House in terms of both the rhetoric and the dominant issue, which is war. Then it says, indeed, Democrats are depending largely on an economic message to erode Bush's advantage among white men. Paul Maslin, the pollster for Dean, said that if the former governor from Vermont wins the nomination, he'll run much better with white men than analysts will expect by offering them a fierce populist critique of the president. I believe that nobody has made the economic or special interest case from the Democratic Party in a fundamental way, and we're going to do it, Maslin said. We're going to go after Bush on deficits, on trade, on cozying up to the corporations, on job loss, on all the hard stuff. Now, Harold, one of the things I think you and I know is, factually, is I was involved in the civil rights movement as early as 1963. And in the election of 1964, the Johnson-Goldwater election, which was a landslide for the Democratic Party, Johnson's excellent positions on civil rights and his terrible positions that turned out on the war in Vietnam, but his excellent positions on civil rights drove the South, the white South, into the Republican Party by 1968. And by 1968, Nixon ran on the Southern strategy.
Right.
In which he basically not even winked, but gave a wink and a nod to the South that if I, Nixon, am elected, I will repeal the core elements of the civil rights agenda. From that point on, Democrats have been in a dilemma. They have been approaching the white male voter in a way to sort of say, I want to approach you from economic populist point of view. I know you're not good on civil rights. I know you're not good on women's rights, abortion rights. I know you like our wars. But you have a real economic problem, which is you're working class people with a declining standard of living. And yet often the effort to make the economic connection has not been as strong as the so-called social concerns of those workers, many of whom voted for George Wallace, for instance, in Detroit, not in the South. So this is sort of the dilemma for the Democratic Party. My two-part opening question to you, Harold, is can this dilemma be overcome? And by running to the left, is it possible for Democrats to take on issues of gender, gay, if not marriage, gay equality, women's rights, affirmative action, and some level of international sanity, and win an election in 2004?
Well, there are a couple of ways to look at that, Eric. One, which was pretty much expounded in a book that came out last year by John Judas and Rui Teixeira, The Emerging Democratic Majority, basically said, look, in the long run, the nation is becoming less white. Metropolitan areas are moving somewhat leftward on social and cultural politics. They call those urban areas idiopolises. And Latino migration is such that the Democrats can basically hew to a number of their liberal policies and at the end of the day prevail. Of course, the question then is, well, when is the end of the day? And Keynes, of course, said in the long run, we're all dead. And obviously, the reelection of Bush, along with perhaps the strengthening of Republican representation in the Senate and the maintenance of their majority in the House, would be a disaster. So there's the long run, and there's now. The Democrats had sort of an answer to the white male problem under Clinton, but I think it was in some ways peculiar to Clinton and his incredible skills as a campaigner and politician. There was an attempt to deracialize the Democratic agenda under Clinton. A lot of the strategic basis of his 92 campaign was the work of his pollster, Stan Greenberg, looking at Macomb County, a county just north of Wayne County, Detroit, which was a white working class county that saw everything through the prism of race and very little through the prism of class. And that was behind things like Clinton's Sister Soldier speech. But it was also behind, you know, the sort of putting people first part of the Clinton campaign and the kind of mild economic populism that he exhibited at that point. So today, the question is how far can you get with, I think, a more muscular economic populism, and what do you do with these other issues, and how far can you go with them, and or how far do you need to run from them? I think the Dean people are right in a number of important regards. I think, you know, if you look at the numbers on this so-called recovery, how much of it is going to profit, how little of it is going to wages, the wage stagnation that's going on, the decimation of manufacturing, and really key swing states, like Ohio, maybe above all. And I think a growing awareness of just the Walmartization of America that I think is actually growing by leaps and bounds within the American public, that you get a real opportunity for some much more legitimately populist positions on issues like trade, to which Howard Dean is, relatively speaking, a Johnny-come-lately, but, you know, so what? If he wants to campaign on it and premise, a good deal of his campaign on that, you know, God bless him, that's all for the good.
Let me ask you just for a second, Harold. We agree, I mean, let's assume for a minute that we're both rooting for a Bush defeat and a Democratic victory, which is my opening position on the 2004 election. We'll discuss it with the Greens at a subsequent show. I think you're right about a muscular, I think that's a good formulation, a muscular populism, but part of a muscular populism gets accused, of course, of class warfare. And we know that a lot of middle-class people and working-class people are ambivalent about the capitalist system, even including their ambivalence towards the rich. On the other hand, as you said, never before in my lifetime, in our lifetimes, have we seen the deterioration of the so-called middle-class working class. The actual conditions of their life, by any objective standards, are worse than I've ever seen. It's very frightening. The frontal attack on both public medical benefits and private medical benefits, having the mechanics gone out on strike on medical benefits, the United Food and Commercial Workers are still on a brutal strike over this. I think you're absolutely right about the Walmartization of the private and the public sector.
Right.
The question is, race in America has had a deeply emotive force that has often trumped objective class interests between, let's say, blacks and whites, or now blacks, Latinos, Asians, and whites.
Right.
Secondly, male supremacy is a very big thing. I mean, I'm picturing, right in the middle of this election, that instead of it being Willie Horton, which was the symbolic black man who Dukakis pardoned, that gay marriage in Vermont becomes the big issue. And as much as Dean tries to talk about the economy and a muscular populism, this election may go down on white men, what they think about gay marriage.
It might, and white men and what they think about Saddam Hussein.
That's right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then Dean is, in a certain sense, probably, well, you know, if any of the other candidates had really stepped forward, you could say that Dean is, in a certain sense, a higher risk candidate than the hypothetical others, although none of them is really, I think, some of these candidates had interesting kinds of potential, you know, perhaps take some of the edge off of that, at least on paper. I think that might be the case with Wesley Clark and John Kerry to a certain degree, but, you know, we have yet to see this go from a point beyond their resumes to actual kind of crossover performance in terms of getting unlikely suspects voting for them. Dean is very much kind of building up a much stronger Democratic base, committed to a lot of the issues you just enumerated. And is it harder for someone with that kind of base and that kind of record to get, let's stereotype for a second, white working class male votes in industrial Ohio? Well, I mean, the short answer is it's not easier. And what would it take to leap that? I mean, I think the Democrats, I don't know. I mean, some of it is needing to identify some family policy that the party is not only pro-abortion, but, you know, is seriously pro-parenthood, which isn't so much a male issue, I know, but, and, you know, wants to make it easier for women who want to have kids, which, in a number of ways it's not, But I think, you know, I think the party also has to have some kind of security posture, which is, you know, they all do, but have to have some real bona fides on this stuff. However, you know, however much the Bush thing is cynical, smoke and mirrors, and you know, to a certain degree, it certainly is that. But the party needs to have some strength in those issues, too. It just needs to have some initial plausibility. And then, you know, on issues of race, the Democrats during, you know, the New Deal, when they were just horrific on race, they just ignored it.
Exactly.
You know, they part of the Democratic coalition was the segregation of South, and that wasn't, you know, something that they wanted to muck with at that point. You know, at that point they issued sort of universal social programs, which still won them the white Southern vote. But, you know, again, in today's supercharged atmosphere, the Republicans try everything under the sun and succeed more often than not in driving wedges there. That's a very hard issue for the Democrats. They're going to look, I mean, Dean was very clear and many of them are clear in supporting affirmative action. But the flip side of that is when Dean says we need to get the votes of the guys with the Confederate flag bumper stickers, you know, Democrats aren't going to get those votes. Those votes are out of reach, and a lot of those votes from the guys who don't have those bumper stickers are out of reach, too.
Exactly. So let's go over a couple of things. I mean, one of the things that I think is really missing from the discussion, and to the degree columnists, writers, people that have any access to the so-called Democratic Party think tank side, is I'm absolutely shocked at the disintegration of the social welfare state as a Democratic Party issue. Now, one of the things we've been saying to low-income Latino and Black and Asian bus riders and white bus riders is, what about the social wage? I mean, so much is being discussed, right? If you listen to Democrats, they're saying things like, well, if I'm elected, I'm going to give more tax credits to people who hire more people, which is insane. I mean, a capitalist never before had to give money to hire workers and exploit them. But what about the fact that the schools are disintegrating, the hospitals are disintegrating, the HMOs are disintegrating for working class people, the parks are disintegrating? I gave a speech to a bunch of college kids in Ohio, Miami of Ohio, and I said, I think the only strategy for you, there's a white audience, is predominantly white audience, is you got to be very rich. Because if I was you, I'd buy my own park, my own school, my own hospital, my own private doctor they're offering you now, you know, is he'll make office hours. Because if you're going to be an average person in the United States, the social programs are going to be disintegrating in front of your very eyes. And I'm very surprised Dean has not taken this up more. Kucinich hasn't taken it up much. And I think otherwise you get into the jobs issue, which Bush has very effectively turned into tax breaks for the corporations and just a pathetic giveaway, which you pointed out, is generating no jobs. But I think for this issue, I think, again, your muscular populism, which I think is a hope, not a masculinist concept.
Right. Yes.
But seriously, an aggressive populism, I don't see coming out of even Dean right now.
Not at that level, no, and it needs to. I think you're right, and I think some of the Democrats are just beginning to test the themes of middle class erosion, and you know they really need to be encouraged to go full tilt boogie there, because I think that absolutely is a point of differentiation, and to the degree that that's an issue, that helps them. It doesn't help Bush. It's a very important issue, not to mention its effect on the society as a whole. But it's I think people are starting to get this now. I do think Walmart as a metaphor is just kind of, people understand this. They do. And I don't think the Democrats can push the whole series of issues around that, around life without benefit, around life without secure middle-income wages. I don't think they can push that enough.
Well, let's go to the other point you raised, which is that you're right that you can't duck the international question. That, for instance, my view is the United States should get out of Iraq. And we had Vijay Prashad on, who actually talked about the possibility of a regional peacekeeping force, a primarily Arab peacekeeping force. But let's look at the particular Democratic candidates. What is Dean exactly putting out? Because what I hear from Dean is, I'm the candidate against the war, but I'm for the existing war. How, after a while, getting credit, it's going to be difficult for him to keep trying to get credit for opposing it and not having an alternate exit strategy.
Well, the only one with a flat declaration of let's get out of there is Dennis Kucinich.
That's right.
There are a lot of people. I mean, Dean is not taking a position that's utterly idiosyncratic to himself. There are a lot of people who think the war was a disaster, but that, you know, we kind of broke the China, and you know we're for giving up. We don't think it should be Paul Bremer in the U.S. that's running the show, though, and whatnot. But think that having broken it, we need to be there for a while. But then that's subject to an empirical test. You know, what the hell are we accomplishing? And all of the candidates have kind of gone back and forth on this to a certain degree, Dean included, because they themselves have gone between an let's get out of there, or, well, the country clearly needs more help, and I guess we're plausibly the only one who can provide it over a certain level. So it's a muddle, and the kind of clarity that existed during the pre-war and the period of the war up until Baghdad was taken really doesn't exist now. And I think, if anything, Dean is a sort of a tribune of the lack of clarity. He expresses that inadvertently pretty well. I don't know that, you know, I mean, it may be that at a certain point there's going to be just overwhelming sentiment to get the hell out. Clearly it's not there yet. And clearly when someone like Dean looks even to his base for prompting on this issue, he doesn't get one clear message back.
Well, I think that's right, but I don't think you can beat Bush without putting one clear message out. And
he may agree with you, but he would tell you, but, you know, off the record, they would say, we don't know what that is yet.
Right. So I think one of the things that, you know, I've always felt about Reagan as a model is, I think sometimes people confuse how well people liked his right-wing message versus just how much they liked the clarity and lack of apology of his message.
Right.
And we keep waiting for this strong-willed Democrat to say, essentially, I'm going to put some cards on the table, even back to the male macho voter, where they could say, I don't agree with this guy, Dean, but he went up against Bush and didn't back down. And I am worried, well, you know, that in a debate, Bush's put up or shut up may really work. So let's end on a couple of last thoughts, Harold. Let's talk about the role of the secondary, and I don't even mind calling them minor candidates in the good sense of the word, Al Sharpton, Carol Moseley Braun, and Kucinich. On the Kucinich side first, I should know the polls better than I do, but it seems like he's polling very weakly. Is that correct?
Yeah, they all are, but Kucinich above all.
Right. In terms of what we would...
Or beneath all.
Right. Do you think that they can play a role in impacting Democratic Party program, influencing a Dean Gephardt or Kerry? I saw Kerry on Kudlow and Cramer on CNBC.
Yeah.
It was pathetic. I mean, this guy, he bowed to the god of capitalism in a way that was slavish, beyond what they even asked him to. I mean, every other sentence was, I love capitalism. I love big business. I love the rich. I thought he was imminently unelectable. But if you look at the other three we mentioned, who are not electable but are supposed to provide that kind of perhaps kernel of some fight that major candidates could take up, do you see them having any influence?
Well, I think Kucinich actually has had some influence a little through his debate appearances and otherwise. I mean, Kucinich kind of expands the boundary a little on issues like globalization and trade, and I think it's helpful. You know, the reason that one of the many reasons why Dean has been able to move considerably from his former positions on this, changing political currents and what have you, but on that kind of thing, Kucinich really is kind of a leading indicator. He kind of establishes, you know, a totally different model of globalization. And then each in their own way, Gephardt and Dean have you know, been moving in that direction themselves. But I think Kucinich really has had some role in sort of pushing that debate farther than it would have gone. Although, you know, actually some of the things that both Dean and Gephardt have said on this have been really interesting. And in Gephardt's case, I'm not carrying a brief for Gephardt, but antedate the campaign. I mean, in particular, Gephardt, with Believe Me, There Was No Constituency Pressure for This, has this whole rap about the need for a global minimum wage, you know. And, you know, I'm glad to hear it. There are actually some surprising points of similarity on some policy issues between Dean and Gephardt, notwithstanding the clear differences about the war and the fact that the whole Dean campaign is sort of an implicit or explicit critique of the failure of Democratic leaders in Washington to function like they're in opposition. Gephardt is certainly guilty of that.
Carl, let me ask you two. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, Sharpton and Mosley Braun, I don't know. I Sharpton is actually going to get some real votes when as the primary season starts unfolding in places like South Carolina. In the 2000 presidential race, exit polling showed that 53% of the people in South Carolina who voted for Gore were African American. I mean, Sharpton gets will get more votes than either Kucinich or Mosley Braun because he's been working a base. I'm not sure how that will actually affect the campaign year. I mean, everyone I think would say that Sharpton has certainly made it possible to stay awake during the Democratic debates. That absent him, some of it would have been just deadly. That doesn't affect policy though.
Last two questions, and we'll try to do them both in about 2-3 minutes total, Harold. The first is, do you think that if Dean wins, that the other candidates can unite around him or they sabotage him, as many did to McGovern? The second question is, what do you see as the significance of the California primary? And I believe you're coming to speak in L.A. on the significance of the California primary.
Well, that's a little more general on sort of the role of L.A. in American politics. But the first question is, I would expect he would get the pro forma support of them all. I would think that off in Joe Lieberman land, it would be pro forma only, and I'm concerned about that. That Lieberman has been playing, it's not just the connection, whatever it may be, with Dean and McGovern, but that Lieberman has been acting like Scoop Jackson acted towards McGovern in 72, that
That's
he's
right.
just about as bad a danger as Richard Nixon, a totally irresponsible, to put it mildly, policy for a Democrat to have. I'm not sure what the role of the California primary could be. If Dean wins Iowa and New Hampshire, and then manages, because you've got all the presumably more moderate, I'm not sure that's the accurate term, but moderate candidates splitting the vote in the February 3rd round of primaries, which includes more conservative states like South Carolina, Oklahoma, and Arizona, although I'm not sure that Arizona fits in that category anymore either. But if Dean wins a bunch of those, this thing could be over on February 4th. If not, March 2nd is really the crucial. Is definitely Super Tuesday with primaries in California, New York, Ohio, and elsewhere. I think Dean, come what may, has to be favored in California and New York. Ohio, if there's an anti-Dean candidate by then, Ohio would be a real interesting test.
Well, let's leave it here, Harold. In the next round, I'd like to talk to you. We can discuss maybe after all those. Super Tuesday is in March?
It's March 2nd.
March 2nd, okay, so I'll remember that. We'll talk maybe between now and the actual election, and one subject I want to put on our next conversation is China bashing, and can we get a Democratic elected without going after China and other things. But it's been a pleasure talking to you, and thanks for the good work you do of essentially tracking the horses and trying to move the Democratic Party to the left, and we'll stay in touch.
I track. I don't bet.
Okay.
Thanks, Eric. Take care.
This is Eric Mann. I just finished with Harold Meyerson, the editor-at-large of American Prospect magazine. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM.